Guitars usually have six strings, but the Brazilian seven-string guitar, commonly used in choro and samba, has a seventh lower string. I've long thought about trying to learn to play the seven-string guitar, but let's be honest, I've got my hands full with just the six strings. Welcome to Strong Songs, a podcast about music. I'm your host, Kirk Hamilton, and I'm so glad that you've joined me, even though I've now done three intro facts in a row about the guitar, and there are, in fact, other instruments in the world. Strong Songs Season 6 is a listener-supported undertaking. I've put a lot of work into this season, and I'm only able to do that because of the support of so many of my wonderful listeners. If you like this show and you want to chip in to help me keep making it, go to patreon.com/strongsongs. On this episode, we're stepping away from pop and rock styles into a whole new world of music, one filled with gentle grooves, lush harmonies, and softly sung melodies, all written by one of the greatest composers of all time. So, let's tune up the band, find the levada, and get cooking. I wish I could remember the moment I realized that Antonio Carlos Jobim was one of the greatest composers of the 20th century, but I think it wasn't quite a moment so much as a gradually dawning realization, a slow rediscovery of a composer whose music I had spent years playing and performing, but whose genius I had never properly understood. As a jazz saxophonist, I had, of course, learned his most famous songs at least well enough to play them on a gig, songs like The Girl from Ipanema, or Decifinado,
se você insiste em classificar.
Both songs that were famously recorded by saxophonist Stan Getz and guitarist João Gilberto on their 1964 eponymous collaboration that would become the record that defined the moment Brazilian music landed in the States, the mid-60s bossa nova craze. As a young jazz musician myself, I became familiar with the repertoire as it was performed by other musicians. I remember being taken with trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie's version of Chega de Saudade, which I knew by its English name, No More Blues. And a few years later, a killer recording of Felicidade, recorded by my improv professor Vince Maggio on a duo album that he made with saxophonist Mark Colby. So I was aware of Jobim, and as my musical education progressed, I was even aware of the depth and importance of his oeuvre, but I still didn't really, truly appreciate his greatness. And then at some point, something began to change. After school, I'd begun to learn guitar, learn to write songs of my own, and take the piano a little bit more seriously, and I started to approach some of Jobim's music from the bottom up, learning to play the chords and the melody at the same time. And finally, I began to see the ornate cleverness, the beauty with which he fused harmony and melody. I have a particularly strong memory associated with sitting at the piano and relearning his classic love ballad, Corcovado. First, I worked out this melody. Then I watched how it interacted with the chords. And I realized how elegant and beautiful this song is. This clearly defined seven-note melodic motif, played once over the opening chord, and then again over a second chord, a diminished chord, a half step lower, which gave it a rich new character, before resolving through a beautiful standard jazz 2-5-1 cadence with a surprise diminished chord, right before the end of the phrase. None of those chord movements are particularly remarkable on their own, but for some reason for me at that moment in my musical development, it was eye-opening. It was so simple but so elegant, the way that it voice-led through chromatic chord movement, the way it all fit together, it was so simple, so straightforward, and yet it worked so well that it still somehow felt elaborate. After that, I found myself regularly at the piano, real book open, learning more and more of Jobim's songs, studying them not as a saxophonist looking to make it through his next casual gig, but as a composer and songwriter, imagining what it would be like to be able to construct something this beautiful and carefully considered. So right now you're probably thinking, okay, cool, so why isn't this episode about Corcovado? And, well, it almost was, but there's one other Jobim song that I haven't mentioned yet, but which was a constant companion to me throughout my musical development, and as much as I love his other songs, it has always had something slightly different about it, some magical combination of music and lyrics, I don't know, mystical energy, vibes, that made it special to me. I first heard it in the late 90s when I was spending a summer at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. I got this CD called A Twist of Jobim that featured a variety of contemporary jazz artists playing Jobim's music, and on the record was a duet between Al Jarreau and Aletta Adams on a song that I'd never heard before called The Waters of March.
A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road, it's the rest of a stump.
Just a few lines in, I realized that this song was doing something different from any other Jobim song that I'd ever heard.
The oak when it blooms, a fox in the brush, the gnat in the wood, the song of the thrush.
It wasn't telling a clear story with a distinct point of view, it was just a list of things.
It's the wind blowing free, it's the end of the slope, it's a beam.
It spiraled and circled and rolled along, and I found myself drawn inexorably along with it.
It's the end of the string, it's the joy in your heart, the foot.
It's a captivating song, and every so often I'd find myself thinking about it, but I never really followed up. I never learned it, and while I would go on to play dozens of Jobim songs on countless gigs, I never did perform it or even see it performed live. It was always there in the background, in my memory.
Dismay in the face, it's a loss, it's a fine,
a spear, a spike.
Of course, Waters of March, known equally well by its Portuguese name, Águas de Março, is one of Jobim's most acclaimed and beloved songs. It's been covered by artists ranging from Art Garfunkel to U2 lead singer Bono, and this version that I'd become familiar with was far from the definitive version. But it hadn't taken on that much weight for me. It was more like a dream I'd once had that had stuck with me year after year, this magical song that wasn't quite like any other song I'd ever heard.
A drift,
a flight,
a wing,
a hawk,
a quail,
the promise of spring,
and the riverbank talks of the waters of March. It's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart.
So fast forward a decade or two, and I was casting about trying to decide which of Jobim's many masterpieces I should feature on the show, when I happened to hear from a musician friend of mine who had a very simple message for me. "Yo," he wrote, "I apologize in advance because I assume this is all you hear in your life, but I have a strong songs recommendation. The Waters of March by Tom Jobim, as recorded by Jobim with Elise Regina." And just like that, that dream in the back of my head came back into focus, and I thought, of course, The Waters of March. I love that song. And so I went and listened to this 1974 recording, known far and wide, though not yet to me, as the definitive recording of this song, and about 30 seconds in, I knew what my episode was going to be about.
É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho, é o resto de toco.
Written by Jobim in 1972, The Waters of March embodies so much of what I love about his music.
É peroba do campo.
É o
both in terms of how he writes and in this version, recorded with Elis Regina and her incredible band on her 1974 album Elis et Tom, how open his songs are to reinterpretation.
É a chuva chovendo, é conversa ribeira das águas de março, é o fim da canção.
It's a song that I'm so excited to talk about on this show, but the moment I began to sketch out what an episode about the Waters of March might look like, I realized that I couldn't do this alone. I was gonna need help.
My name is Frederico Barros. I go with Fred, and I'm a musicology professor at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, which we call Universidade Federal do Rio de Janeiro, in Brazil.
Fred had reached out a few years back just to say that he enjoyed strong songs, and as a Brazilian musicologist, he was considering making a similar kind of show with a focus on the rich and varied world of Brazilian music. I said, of course, that sounds like an amazing idea, and while he hasn't launched that show yet, I hope someday that he will. In the meantime, we kept in touch, and when it was time to make an episode about Jobim, I knew just who to ask to come on the show and talk to me about him.
I was born in 79. Like, my parents' generation is the generation which grew up with Jobim's and Elis Regina's music as, like, their main reference. And I grew up listening to this music. And I know it's kind of cliche, like, people always say this, oh, I grew up with this music, but in my case, this is really true. Like, my parents never liked João Gilberto that much, but they liked Jobim, and they liked the generation, the core of what we call MPB, which is MPB, which is Brazilian popular music.
Unsurprisingly, Fred turned out to be a font of information on this subject, so you'll be hearing from him throughout this analysis as, with an assist from him, I try to get at the heart of what it is that makes this song and this recording of it so magical. There is a whole complicated backstory behind the making of this record. Elis et Tom were from different generations, she a 20-something up-and-coming singer, he a successful 40-something composer in a bit of a comedown after the heights of the bossa nova craze of the previous decade. And there's actually a new documentary about the making of this album that gets into all of it, though I haven't seen that documentary, and I actually didn't know that it existed when I decided to make this episode. Suffice it to say, Elis et Tom, their collaboration wasn't super smooth at first, but as they began to work together, along with her pianist who was handling the arrangements and the rest of her band, something very special began to emerge. Of course, in order to talk about this band, I have to correctly pronounce each of their names, and I realized I had someone who could help me with that. So for starters, the title of the song is
Águas de Março.
Águas de Março.
This is the accent from Rio de Janeiro, which is my accent.
Mm-hmm.
People in São Paulo would say Águas de Março.
Okay, it's a little bit different.
But like, my accent is the correct one, okay?
Okay, sure. perfect, okay. Antônio Carlos Jobim.
Antônio Carlos Jobim. Tom Jobim, as we say it. Tom Jobim.
Elis Regina.
Elis, because I'm from Rio. Elis Regina.
From there, we ran down the individual band members. First on piano,
César Camargo Mariano.
On guitar,
Hélio Delmiro.
As well as
Oscar Castro Neves.
On drums,
Paulo Braga.
On bass,
this is the good one, Luizão Maia. I mean, the good one because I know Luizão, the ão is hard for other people. Yeah.
Luizão.
Luizão.
Ão.
Yeah. It's my vendetta because I struggle with the English all day, so I'm having my vendetta with you.
Right. The remaining names, Hubert Laws and Jerome Richardson on the flute, were easier for me to pronounce. And that's the band, a really incredible group of musicians who brought so many cool ideas and played together with such subtle, organic interactions that it feels at times like they were of one mind. So let's start at the top and take this thing apart.
É o fim do caminho, é o resto de toco, é um pouco sozinho, é um caco de vidro, é a vida, é o sol, é a noite, é a morte, é o laço, é o anzol, é peroba do carro.
For many years, I simply referred to Jobim's music as Bossa Nova. There was a whole period of time where I probably would have called this recording Bossa Nova, but it's more complicated than that. There's no way that I can capture all of the subtleties and layered distinctions between all of the different styles of Brazilian music on this episode. We're going to have to wait for Fred to release his own podcast for that. Styles like choro and samba, or bossa nova, which is an offshoot of samba. Those are all amazing. There's so much complexity, and they can be blended and have been blended in so many interesting ways over the years. However, Fred did help me with a few terms and concepts, starting with the levada, which is an important concept for understanding how a band knows how to interpret and perform a given piece of music.
The levada is, it can be thought of as the beat, but usually the beat is something that we use just for drums, I guess, in English. And imagine that each instrument has its own beat, which goes together with the other instrument's beat for you to create some rhythm.
Later, Fred emailed me to elaborate on that, just to be sure that he was communicating what a levada really is. He wrote, quote, "The way we see it in general is like an accompaniment pattern. The thing is, it isn't really a fixed pattern. Everyone plays to a given levada, but doesn't specifically play it. It varies both in the sense that you play variations to it all the time and in the sense that it itself can be slightly different for each of the musicians playing, even those who are playing the same instrument." Instrument, unquote.
As pazes, mas depois fui eu quem dele...
The genre and the rhythm sometimes share the same name, but they aren't the same thing. So, for example, we have another kind of music which is very important, which is choro. And, for example, choro, you have some choros which are like this. A samba levada. It's a samba beat, which is part of choro, but there are choros which are, for example, this one. This is what we call maxixe. It's part of choro, but the rhythm is maxixe. And that's the thing. Sometimes people can, like, okay, so I'm gonna do a samba beat, and the other instrument will be doing a choro beat on top of that. Or the other instrument would be doing triplets on top of that. And like, you have lots of different polyrhythms, which is something that people used to do since the 1920s. There's lots of that in Elise's band from this time.
So the musicians in the band were breaking new ground and experimenting in ways that might not be immediately apparent to a less familiar ear, like, say, mine. Each musician would play a slightly different type of groove, and by layering those different grooves on top of one another, they got something that sounded new. So that's something that I want you to keep in mind as we get into this recording, the way that the grooves layer on top of one another, and how that, along with the electric bass, synthesizers, and electric guitars in this band, were actually pretty non-traditional and avant-garde for the time period. So we'll get into all of that, but let's start with the harmony.
É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho, é o resto de toco.
Waters of March is often played in the key of C, but Elise Tom took it down a step in B flat. It's a somewhat hypnotizing, destabilizing song to learn and perform because it never really lands, so it can be hard to orient yourself. It flows downhill, never pooling, always moving somewhere new. So I want you to return to this concept that we've talked about here in season 6, the concept of directionality, and to really get into the directionality of this song as we begin to analyze it. The Waters of March is an endless downward spiral, almost like an Escher painting or a Shepherd tone. It's this beguiling series of chords and melodies that somehow keeps going downward, despite the fact that it's also sometimes going up. The song begins with both guitars playing the same part. Enjoy it because it's basically the only time that happens.
É pau, é
Here at the start, they're playing a B-flat major triad over a flat, which is actually a tonality that we've talked about recently. It's actually a sound that keeps coming up this season for whatever reason. It's a 2 over 1, which is a kind of a Lydian sound. Now, because we're in the key of B-flat, it's really a 1 over flat 7, but that's kind of semantic. The sound is Lydian. So from there, the chords begin the downward spiral of the song, and the thing to listen for is the way that the chords voice lead from one to the next to the next. Voice leading refers to the way that, in a given series of chords, individual notes within those chords, which are called voices, naturally lead from one to the next. So one voice in a certain chord will naturally lead into a corresponding voice in the subsequent chord. Jobin was a master of voice leading, and his melodies and chord progressions often move in very closely voice-led ways, as we'll get into. And for those of you who aren't as familiar with this concept, I think it'll become clearer when we talk about the melody, because the melody to this song has really strong voice leading in it. It gives his songs this beautiful, very logical feeling that I at least find very comforting. Let me show you, starting with the chords. So we'll start with this first chord, B flat over A flat, and that means that there's an A flat in the bass. The next chord after that is a G minor sixth, so the bass note drops just a half step, and the F that was on top of that B flat triad also drops a half step down to E, which is the sixth in G6. The other notes stay the same, so there's just this feeling that the chord is shifted. There's definitely a new harmony, but it hasn't gone that far from the chord that preceded it. Okay, so we've gone from B flat over A flat to G minor sixth. Then we just keep going down. The bass note drops another half step and we get E flat minor 7 over G flat. Then it drops another half step, then another. Each time the chord slightly changes in this logical downward trajectory. So listen to the recording now and really focus on the bass and on the harmony. I'll play along on piano and just notice how each chord moves a little bit downward from the one before it.
É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. É o resto de toco, é pouco sozinho. É caco de vidro, é a vida, é o sol. É a noite, é a morte, é laço, é anzol.
So you can hear it, right? I don't want to get too bogged down in chord names. This song has a lot of lovely jazz chords, half-diminished chords, diminished chords, minor major 7 chords, plenty of slash chords with non-root tones in the bass. And for a lot of you out there, that's not really all that helpful. And even for those of you out there who do know all those chords, it's not really the point. The point is the way this song flows like water. It runs downhill, resetting every few phrases really elegantly in a way that you almost don't notice, so that it can flow downhill again. So that's the basic harmonic framework of the song. Before we get into the melody, let's break down the arrangement. The core of this arrangement is a pair of guitars, bass, and drums. The guitars are played by, and pardon my inability to match Fred's pronunciation, Helio Del Miro and Oscar Castro Neves. I'm not sure the specific guitars that they're playing. It could be that they're both playing electric semi-hollow guitars. For my recreation, just to make it sound like two different players, I went with an acoustic guitar, a steel string acoustic guitar, which is heresy, I know, but I don't have a nylon string acoustic, so a steel string acoustic guitar, which sounds like this. And a semi-hollow body electric jazz guitar, which sounds like this. I put the acoustic on the left and the electric on the right and got a pretty nice sound out of it. Now listen to the original recording and pay attention to what happens with the guitars when the drums enter.
É pedra, é o fim do caminho.
Really cool, right? The way they split apart. That gets at something that Fred was talking about earlier with the way that different musicians in a band will play with the levada in different ways, which creates layered, rhythmically complementary parts. The guitar on the left goes with a strict upbeat groove. There's something more samba about it, if I'm not mistaken. It sounds like this. By contrast, the guitar on the right goes with more of a downbeat-heavy groove that sounds like this. Put them together and you get this lovely complementary ping-ponging sound. That effect is greatly emphasized by the contrast with the first few bars of the song where both guitars are playing the exact same part. That's on purpose. It's a subtle but really cool trick. So next up we have the drums played by the great Paulo Braga. He's playing quietly here, but with such a strong groove. I really love the drumming on this track. He's using brushes on the snare instead of drumsticks, and he's got a steady kick pattern, and the hi-hat is going on 2 and 4, and that's basically it, but he uses those three textures to create so much depth and variety in his parts. So brushes, wire brushes, are interesting because they change up the role of the snare drum in the old thump, pop, sizzle, groove hierarchy. As most of you probably know, I like to think of grooves in terms of three elements, the thump, the pop, and the sizzle. Often the thump is a kick drum, something low that drops the anchor points for the groove. The pop is something higher, often a snare drum, which offsets the downbeaty thump to add energy to the groove. And then there's the sizzle, which can be a lot of different things. It can be hi-hat, it can be a shaker or a tambourine. It fills in the gaps in between the thumps and the pops and further fleshes out the groove. When you're playing snare with a stick, the pop is often pretty clear. Pop! You hit the drum with the stick. Wire brushes, however, open the door to a lot of other textural and timbral possibilities. You can do what's called stirring, where you press one of your brushes against the surface of the snare and push it around, which creates this steady tone. Braga is doing that, and that uses the snare to make a sort of a sizzle, which fills in the groove along with periodic pops that he's also dropping on the snare with the brush that's in his other hand. It's a great example of how much depth and dynamism brushes can add to a drummer's groove. And like I said, I really love his playing on this track.
É a chuva chovendo, é conversa ribeira das águas de março, é o fim da canseira.
É o pé, é o chão.
That leaves the bass, yet another crucial aspect of this recording, played by the great Luiz Omaya, and these bass lines, performed on an electric Fender P bass, were one of the things that most dramatically set the sound of this band apart from the more traditional sound and from the bossa nova bands of the 1960s. Fred pointed out that to these younger musicians, the more traditional sounds of the previous generation were démodé, they were outdated and old sounding. A more traditional Brazilian ensemble, like the bands that Fred plays with, wouldn't have a bass at all. Instead, the guitarist would play a 7-string guitar, and that extra string would be dedicated to contrapuntal bass lines.
There's no 7-string guitar in her recordings. There's an electric bass, which is not doing what the 7-string guitar is doing. Because the 7-string guitar is like... lots of counterpoint. There's nothing like that in her music. It was démodé for them. That's the thing.
So a very different approach to the bass compared with what Elisha's band was doing. Their approach was more in line with how an American jazz band might interpret this style of music. The bass lines would adjust to the melody, but they weren't nearly so composed and contrapuntal.
É o projeto da casa, é o corpo na cama.
Not only that, but Maya was playing on an electric bass, which Maya played with his fingernails to get the crisp, punchy attack that he got, and it really enhanced his great time feel. I couldn't recreate that sound exactly, but I did my best, and if you line the bass up with the drums, you get something pretty nice that really emphasizes the downbeat of every bar. That downbeat-focused bounce offsets nicely against the guitar parts. So those are the basics of the groove. However, there is a lot more going on in this arrangement, which, remember, was by Cesar Carmajo Mariano, starting with these piano parts. And I should say here that I'm not totally sure who played which parts. Both Mariano and Jobim have piano credits on this track, and Jobim's piano playing was very much the kind of elegant, understated minimalism that turns up on this track. So yeah, not totally sure who's playing what. So first, there's this jangly, out-of-tune second piano that occasionally plays during this arrangement. It's really weird and distinct. It's a very important part of this recording. It plays these crunchy, half-step dissonant stabs, including one at the very beginning. On its own, it sounds like this. Listen for it in the recording. It happens again a bit later in the verse. I don't know, it's weird, but I love it. So then there's the more traditional piano part, which is just a model of restraint. It's so hip. The piano doesn't enter for a little bit, but when it does, it's just these single note voice leading lines played in octaves before finally transitioning to full chords. As the band moves through the chord progression, they do some really cool and subtle tricks to add variety to the groove. And I really want you to listen for that when you listen to this song. Listen for all of the subtle things that the rhythm section is doing to shake things up. For example, there's this sequence early on when Braga drops these playful open hi-hat hits on the 2 and 4 that add this lovely bounce to the pulse. Or later, when Maya and Braga coordinate to start anticipating every chord, pushing the whole chord progression up a beat onto the 4. Here, listen to that again, and I'll just count along with the bass line and check out how the bass plays each new chord on beat 4 of the bar before when it would normally play. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4. That definitely feels to me like some young players testing the limits of what they can do and what traditions they can toss aside. The remarkable thing is how effortlessly it fits under the vocals. You almost wouldn't notice that they're playing over the bar line there. It's so hip. So last, I want to talk about the melody. And like a lot of things about this song, the melody to The Waters of March can be a bit slippery. It's been sung by so many different artists in so many different ways that it's hard to get too prescriptive about what the melody is and what it isn't. But there are a few general melodic ideas at work, and they use voice leading in different ways.
É pau, é pedra, é o fim do caminho.
First of all, there's the melody that begins the song. It's a set of 3 notes, 3-2-1, down the major scale. It repeats a bunch of times, even as the chords change, which means those 3 notes take on a different quality over each chord. So a lot of times the melody is in that mode. It's just 3-2-1 over and over again as the chords shift underneath it. This is a melodic trick that Jobim really liked to use. The melody stays put while the chords move. Girl from Ipanema does this on the first 2 phrases. Mm-hmm. My beloved Corcovado does this with the opening two phrases. Other songs like the one-note samba do this. He was very, very good at writing static melodies with moving harmony underneath. So a lot of times the melody to Waters of March is doing that. It's just 3-2-1 as the chords shift underneath it. However, the other melody in this song is a much more logical, voice-led kind of thing. It starts by jumping up to the root, then it drops to the sixth, then to the flat sixth, and then to the fifth, returning to the B-flat in between each note. So it's a melody that beautifully voice leads through the changes, B-flat to G to G-flat to F, and it happens over and over again. Listen for it in the recording, and I'll play along with that melody.
Passarinho na mão,
pedra de atiradeira.
É uma ave no céu,
é uma ave no chão.
É regato, é uma fonte,
é pedaço de pão.
So no matter what the melody is doing or what the singer who's interpreting it is choosing, there's so much voice leading in this song. Every chord leads to the next one, and that's crucial to the way that the song flows. It flows like water. Each chord, each melody note is just an eddy in a gentle river running ever onward. So let's listen to all of that, and we're going to start with my version and then transition into the recording. And even more so than usual, my version does not come close to the original in terms of style or certainly authenticity, but it was really instructive to try to put it together, and it helped me appreciate just how much each musician in this band brought to the overall sound. So let's listen, and as always, keep your ears open for everything I just talked about. Hear the way the two guitar parts, panned left and right, offset one another rhythmically to create this nice ping-pong effect. Catch how the piano enters at the top with that jangly half-step stab, and then enters later on with a tasteful voice-led octave line. Listen to how the drums use that stirring brush on the snare to fill in the space between snare hits, and how he drops those little open hi-hat accents onto a couple of bars, and listen to how the bass bounces along under the pulse, then works with the drums and the piano to push the chords up a beat, anticipating them across the bar line even as the melody remains in its usual place. And while you're hearing all that, also catch how the chord progression spirals downward again and again, with each chord leading to the next one in a gentle voice-led descent, and how the melody alternates between a simple static line and a more vertical voice-led line. Rather than try to sing this melody, I decided to play the melody on saxophone, so hopefully the lack of lyrics will help you focus on what the melody is doing. Okay, it's a lot to take in and it's all pretty subtle, but just kick back, relax, put your ears on, and let's do it. So those are this song's musical basics. Waters of March doesn't really work like most songs in that it doesn't have a traditional form, AABA or anything like that. It's just this one endless chord progression unspooling down from B-flat over and over and over again. That's unusual, and it's also unusual from a lyrical standpoint, and its lyrics are, of course, a big part of what makes it so special and enchanting.
É o fundo do poço, é o fim do caminho. No rosto, desgosto, é um pouco.
rather than telling a story or relaying a lover's lament or anything like that, The Waters of March is a list. It's a list of feelings, ideas, and objects that one might encounter in the Brazilian countryside at the end of the March rainy season. Jobim wrote both the English and Portuguese lyrics, and while I know a lot of people find the Portuguese lyrics to be more specific and meaningful, I gotta say, the first time I heard this song, it was in English, and those lyrics really made an impression on me. I found it beautiful.
The range of a boat, the bed of the well, the end of the line, the dismay in the face, it's a loss, it's a fine.
A spear, a spike, a point, a nail, a drip, a drop, the end of the tale.
It's a song about the beauty of nature and the simple life, but it's also a song about death and about the natural cycles of our existence. There's something comforting about that. I find this song to be remarkably cozy, even though it's not overly concerned with making me feel that way. The English lyrics begin, a stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. I mean, that's not exactly an overly romantic view of the simple life in the country. It's more of an existentialist story than that. It's the rest of a stump. It's a little alone. Many of the lyrics contain some element of endings or death or broken, malfunctioning things. It's a sliver of glass, and then it is life, it's the sun, and then it is night, it is death, it's a trap, it's a gun.
It's a sliver of glass, it is life, it's the sun, it is night, it is death, it's a trap, it's a gun.
The oak when it blooms, a fox in the brook.
It's less sad than melancholy, and very peaceful in that melancholy.
The wood of the wind, a cliff, a fall, a scratch, a look.
While also being calm and comforting. Always that refrain as the riverbank talks of the waters of March.
And the riverbank talks of the waters of March. It's the end of the strain, it's the joy in your heart.
The city guy goes to the countryside and you're paying attention to the birds and to the water and these things. So I think the superficial meaning of the song offers you this, but I think it has some kind of existentialist vibe. And I think this generation is totally existentialist, all these guys, like from Michelangelo Antonioni to Jobim to everybody. There's an overall feeling for the song, which for me taps into this philosophical existentialist thing. I don't know, existentialism is a funny thing because it's not really pessimistic. It's like indifferent, but you can feel well inside of that indifference.
One of the wildest things about this song and its lyrical effect is how it has the same effect on me when I listen to Elise and Tom sing it in Portuguese, even though I don't know exactly what they're saying. It's something about the cadence, the flow between them. The gist comes across, even if the specifics are lost in translation. I ran the Portuguese lyrics through an online translator and was surprised at how close a lot of them are to their English counterparts. I suppose that makes sense since Jobim wrote both versions. However, there are a few differences in some lyrics that are specific to Brazil in ways that just don't translate. I asked Fred about those. The first one he pointed out was É o fundo do poço, which in the English lyrics is translated more literally as the bed of the well.
É o fundo do poço, which is, it's the bottom of the well, which is an expression in Portuguese, which means, man, it's the bottom of the bottom, the fundo do poço. You have reached like
rock bottom?
Yeah, the rock bottom. And he says after that, é o fim do caminho, it's the end of the way, it's the end of the pathway. Some disgust, it's a little alone. I'm being very literal in this case.
The end of the line, the dismay in the face, it's a loss, it's a fine.
Over and over, this song will do that. The ideas and images that it conjures don't always mean the same thing on their own as they do when placed in the sequence. Even in the more literal English version, the bed of the well takes on a different meaning when it's on its own compared with when you say, the bed of the well, the end of the line, you know? And then when you add, the dismay in the face, it's a loss, it's a find, it's so good.
The bed of the well, the end of the line. dismay in the face. It's a loss, it's a fine,
a spear.
Some of the lyrics don't translate at all. Early in this recording, Jobim sings, "It's Matita Pereira," which Google Translate tells me means it's a bird, but turns out means a lot more than that.
And Matita Pereira, it's like it's a folklore figure. It's a witch.
Okay.
She turns into a bird.
Sure.
And she goes to your house and she stays on top of at the top of your house, like making noises, bird noises, all night until you get so angry you have to give her something. You promise to give her something in the following day, and usually tobacco or, I don't know, something like that. Coffee, cachaça, which is distilled drink of sugar cane, something like that. And then she comes the next day, and if you don't give her, then you get a curse.
A little bit later, Elish sings the lyrics, "Festa de Cumiera," which has a specific meaning that actually has an analog in America.
Cumi is the peak of something. It's an old tradition too that exists in France and in other places, in which you build a house and all the community helps you to build the house. And then at the end, when you put the last part of the rooftop, which is the cumieira, you throw a party in which you give food to everybody as a way of a thankful note for the people who have helped you. So that's it.
So it's similar to a barn raising. And I love all these little specific details, since the song really is an entire litany of details that, together, coalesce into something greater. Probably my favorite lyric in the entire song is the same in both languages, when the singer tells of a car that got stuck and then sings, "It's the mud, it's the mud.
And the car that got stuck, it's the mud, it's the mud."
I get the sense that Al Giroux likes that line too. Portuguese version has the same idea, though of course the lyrics are different. E a lama, e a lama. And oh man, that bass riff right there. Luis Almayo, he drops the bottom out for a couple of beats. Just ridiculously good. Maybe that's his interpretation of a car getting stuck in the mud. This song has so many little musical moments like that, when the rhythm section drops little accents or embellishments that perfectly augment the vocals. There are too many to catalog here, but I hope you'll keep an ear out for them the next time you listen. It's a delightful experience to just focus on the rhythm section. And I'd say that because I don't fully understand every word that the singers are singing, it actually makes it easier for me to do that. It's something that I find really pleasurable about this version of the song. A couple other things I want to draw your ear to for you to listen for. First, there's this interesting flute hybrid synth pad thing going on that doesn't exactly fit with the rest of the arrangement, but I still find it to be this beguiling presence. You'll hear it from time to time floating in and out of the arrangement underneath the vocals. It really fleshes things out in these segments when the bass starts pedaling. There's also this recording's brilliant and subtle use of whistling. On the bridge, the piano takes over for a few bars, playing this jangly high melody that sounds strangely chipped and out of tune. It isn't until you listen closely that you realize someone's whistling along with the piano part. It's such an unusual and perfect choice. It humanizes the recording in this very playful way. You might not even notice what you're hearing, but you'll still hear it. It takes what would ordinarily be a normal piano part like this. And just slightly turns it on its head. It's subtle, but it's so cool. It's a trick that I am definitely going to steal in the future, and just one of the many reasons that this song doesn't really sound like any other songs. At this point, the song has largely been developed, the list has largely been made, so it's time to bring it home.
É uma cobra, é um pau.
É João.
É José.
É um espinho.
Na mão.
É um corte.
No pé.
São as águas de março fechando o verão. É a promessa de vida.
The two singers begin to collide a little bit more, trading quicker phrases in fragments of phrases, which gives the song a more playful energy. And then, after one more time through the refrain, they get to my favorite part of the song. I'm just gonna let it play on the off chance you haven't heard it, because you should really hear it.
Pedra,
vinho,
peste,
oco,
ovo,
vinho,
agro,
hidro,
ida,
ol,
oite,
orte,
aço,
sol.
São as águas de março fechando o verão.
So I, of course, fell in love with this section the first time I heard it, though I couldn't tell what they were doing exactly. Were these just sounds they were making? Was this improvised? It turns out they were playing around with the lyrics of the song, singing the ends of words that they'd sung in full earlier on.
They are just playing with the last half of the words. So, é pau, é pedra. So they go, pau, edra, which would be pedra.
So in English, a version of this would be, instead of singing a stick, a stone, you would sing ick, and the other singer would sing own, and then instead of road, you'd say ode, and the other singer would say ump, and you would just keep going like that, and you can kind of start to see why Elish begins to laugh. I really think that this moment, captured on tape as it was, is a big reason that this recording endures and why people love it so much. It's actually pretty rare for a studio recording to feature a singer laughing, just like really laughing while she sings. It's kind of a funny thing about singing. Singers can channel so much emotion into their voice and their performance, but when it comes to the actual sounds that our voices make when we're feeling big feelings, laughing, crying, those sounds are much less common when it comes to vocal performance. And it's what makes this moment so special, and it lifts up the entire recording. From here, Elise gets silly with it. A momentary indulgence before she reins it back in for the end of the song. A couple extra notes, a bit of whistling, and they're done.
I never cared much for Elis Regina, actually, because she's too intense. Though I always recognized she's a great singer and all that. But finally, preparing for this episode today, during my commute coming home, and I was listening to things and choosing other songs, and I have to say I was really moved by her singing.
I know that feeling of growing up with an artist, forming a relationship with their work, and then returning to them many years later and rediscovering something new. I'm in a constant state of rediscovering Antonio Carlos Jobim. Seemingly every week, I find a new, beautiful version of one of his songs. This version, however, feels a little different to me. Something in what Elis Regina brought out in Jobim and what he brought out in her. Two very different artists at different points in their creative careers careening into one another in a moment at once carefully choreographed and unrepeatably serendipitous. The waters of March, Aguas de Mars, amounts to a list of things, objects and observations from a life rolling downhill toward the riverbank.
É a promessa de vida no teu coração.
This song and this performance of it, they both contain multitudes. Joy and sadness, death and rebirth, injuries and parties and firewood and birds and bits of bread, water and mud, long talks and deep mysteries. And every time I listen to it, all those possibilities open anew. And that'll do it for my analysis of The Waters of March, as recorded by Elish Regina and Tom Jobin. I hope you enjoyed this episode and that it inspires some of you out there to give this album a spin and to check out both Jobin and Regina's music. There is so much great stuff to discover. A huge thank you to Fred Barros for lending his time and expertise to the show. I can't say enough how much he helped me better understand Brazilian music, even if I never quite got my pronunciations dialed in. His students are lucky to learn from him. Fred has actually assembled a playlist for anyone out there who would like to explore more Brazilian artists, along with an amazing list of notes and extra information that Fred included for each track. Definitely check that out. There's so much good stuff there. This episode was made with production support from Emily Williams. Thanks, Emily. Thanks to Chris Remo for sending the text message that reminded me of this song and led to the creation of this episode. And thank you to my patrons, to everyone who supports this show on Patreon. You all make it possible for me to spend the time it takes to make an episode like this one. So if you're enjoying Strong Songs Season 6, I hope you'll consider becoming a patron of the show or making a one-time donation. There are links for both of those things down in the show notes. Of course, no worries if you can't directly support the show. You can also spread the word. You can recommend Strong Songs to someone you know who might like it. You can leave a review wherever you're listening, or you can just keep listening. I really just appreciate your time. I have been having a lot of fun with Season 6 so far, and I'm very excited about the upcoming episodes. That'll do it for now, though. Links for all kinds of things are down in the show notes. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new edition of Strong Covers, which is going to be a lot of fun. Until then, take care and keep listening.